96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Wednesday, August 3rd. And it's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Once again, this is C.A. Nuri, and I shall be your host for today as we continue a conversation about service to one's country. So in order to assist me with this term service, about the history of service, about given to oneself, I have the Honorable Frederick Mitchell with me. Yeah, that's right. I was able to secure Fred Mitchell to be on the show and to give a history of himself. We're going to talk about him growing up in New Providence, about his family, about him going to school, about him working in media, and to and conclude basically with him being a minister of government. So without further ado, I wanted to introduce my member of parliament, Fox Hill, the greatest member of parliament there is, because he knows all of my children's name, he knows my dog name, he knows my neighbor's name. He can come and knock on the door and I say, oh God, that's Fred Mitchell again. You know? So without further ado, let me introduce to you Frederick Mitchell.
Morning. I'm glad to be here. And I apologize for my wheeziness, but I've been trying find this. Yeah.
You're cool with me. But let me start the conversation. You are Frederick Mitchell. They call you Fred Mitchell. I want to know your family history, your family lineage. Who are your parents? Who are your grandparents? You know?
Well, my father was Frederick Audley Mitchell, Sr.
So you're a junior?
Right. I used to carry junior until he passed away in 1999.
Okay.
And up until I went to St. Augustine's College, I was called Audley at home. So if you want to know my friends up to that time, if you hear somebody call me Audley, then that was before 1965, mm-hmm. when I went to St. Augustine's. And then they started using my first name.
Mm-hmm.
And my father's side of the family, best we know, is from San Salvador, mm-hmm. from the settlement of United Estates. I was told my grandfather came to Nassau when he was 14, and so therefore my father didn't know his parents, his grandparents. And he was raised by the Richardson family in Burial Ground Corner, around mm-hmm. here in Bayonetown. And my father's parents built, Albert Miller told me, we were the only family that had a stone house in Bayonetown. In 3P's Corner, which is now mm-hmm. called Finlayson Street. So that's my father's side of the family. He was christened at St. Agnes Church in 1919. He was born in February 1919. My mother was a Ford, and she was a Ford. Her mother was a Hannah.
Okay.
And she was the daughter of Robert Hannah, who was a merchant and landowner on the mm-hmm. on East Bay Street. And I thought that she was actually from the pond all of her life, but I later learned from Ralph Wood, who was the former controller of road traffic and the longest serving people's warden at St. Agnes, that she was actually born in Augusta Street and was christened at St. Agnes as well in 1923. So I have the baptismal certificates mm-hmm. to show for that. The reason I mention it that way is because both my parents then came from Bayonetown.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, as an Africanist myself, I feel very strongly attached to Bayonetown as the kind of root of my existence here in the Bahamas. And my nephews and nieces are always quizzing what goes behind all of this, but we can't get back very far. Now, people keep saying that Mitchell is actually anglicized from Michelle, and they think it comes from Haiti, but we've not been able to trace father back. So that's me.
I see you mentioned, I know you as a historian, a lay historian. You collect data and retell stories. So you're a griot, as they say in Africa. You tell stories also. But you also mentioned that your mother is a Ford and she originates from the Hannah Hasty Tynes family. Mm-hmm. And I know you have attended a number of events of the Hannah Hasty Tynes family. Mm-hmm. And I have traced your family lineage to 1783, that right. Your family have been in the Bahamas.
Right.
And you are related, which I found amusing, to people like Glenys Hannah Martin.
That's right.
You want to see in family tree?
Well, the interesting thing about Glenys Hannah Martin is that I think it's the connection is my great-grandfather and her great-grandfather, I believe, are brothers, I believe.
You're fairly close then.
Yeah. So when he was, you know, I stand to be corrected, but when he was a student at the government high school, he left Pompey B. Acklands, where he was from and born, and Arthur Hanna, that is, mm-hmm. the late governor general and former deputy prime minister, came to Nassau and lived with my grandmother during the time that he was in high school.
Nice.
So,
and remind me who your grandmother was.
My grandmother's name was Gwendolyn Ford,
okay.
Nee Hanna. She happened to be a Ford because she was married, and this is how she ended up being born in Baynetown. She was married, and my mother ended up being born in Baynetown. She was married to a man who was a Ford who migrated to the Bahamas as a baby, as a one-year-old baby, with his family from Barbados.
Okay.
I guess my great-grandfather came here to be a tailor for the Royal Bahamas Police Force.
Mm-hmm.
So that turned out to be her father, and that's how she became a Ford, and my mother later became a Ford. They had a piece of property in Augusta Street,
mm-hmm.
and so that's where my mother ended up being born in Augusta Street. And then the other part of it is the maternal side of my paternal grandparents. My grandmother was a Wish,
mm-hmm.
And she was the sister of another Wish who was married to a Johnson. So you may know Ivan Johnson,
mm-hmm.
Ivan Johnson, Felicity Johnson, Janet Johnson. They are my second cousins.
You relate to everybody.
That's right. Our grandmothers were sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And the two families were very close. They grew up in Grantstown. And my father was from Baynetown, and everybody went to St. Agnes,
yes.
of course, was the and which is the church that I go to.
I'm just going to ask if you still attend St. Agnes
yeah,
Church.
Yeah, I'm the only one of my siblings actually christened in St. Agnes
mm-hmm.
In 1953. My mother, when she came back from school in New York, lived with her aunt, Mrs.
Mm-hmm.
Ford, Olive Ford, in Chippingham. And the mission church in Chippingham was Holy Spirit, the Anglican church there. And so she started going to church at that church. And so all the others were actually christened at St. Mary's, which
mm-hmm.
was the Mother Church of Holy Spirit. And my mother, I was just telling the rector this morning of Holy Spirit that my mother was actually the organist at Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
She and Grace Archer, Sunday for Sunday, were the organists there. So that completes, I think, the picture, at least going back to my grandparents.
Yes. Yeah. But you seem to have your navel string buried in Baynetown and, of course, St. Agnes, that particular area there.
Yeah. From a biological point of view, that's absolutely correct. But intellectually, the person who's actually responsible for me being an active member of St. Agnes is actually Archdeacon William Thompson.
Okay.
Late Archdeacon William Thompson. And I was very fortunate throughout most of my life, from the time I was a child, to have been taken into the guardianship, so to speak, of a number of people who were prominent citizens.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know at the time. But when I came back from university, I became very close friends with him. He invited me, for example, to become a member of the Lunch Bunch.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one who was the intellectual thrust behind the kind of nationalist movement in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And so things like naturally joining the PLP, naturally ending up being an Africanist, it was almost organic. People like Dr. Cleveland Enius,
mm-hmm.
Archdeacon William Thompson, Dean William Granger, who was the brother, my aunt, my father's sister, was married to his brother, who was a man named Wenzel Granger, who served on the Royal Bahamas Police Force and got up to the rank of deputy commissioner, and then later became director of immigration. And it was through these people, including Samuel Isaacs, who is the father of John Isaacs, the Court of Appeal judge,
mm-hmm.
and is one, again, coming down from the Hanna line again.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel Isaacs was a member of Parliament. He was the son of Dame Albertha Isaacs,
mm-hmm.
who was the...
And all these are on the Hanna.
Hannas, they're all Hannas, mm-hmm. yeah. And so I got to be around persons who were associated with government and public policy. So because of Wenzel Granger, when I left primary school...
What primary school did you go to?
I went to Eastern Junior
mm-hmm.
School. Well, first, I started off at St. George's
mm-hmm.
School, the Anglican Church School, taught by English nuns who were here at the time. And then two women, Miss Lightburn, who is still alive, and Mrs. Culmer, who has sadly passed away. Michael Eldon was then the priest,
mm-hmm.
and he later... left to become archdeacon in Grand Bahama, and then ultimately became the first Anglican bishop of Bahamian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these are people that I grew up around and were in some way mentored.
I know you mentioned the term Africanist twice in this conversation. Can you explain what that is?
I pay a lot of obeisance and respect to the fact that I have an African ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
And in this society, of course, the dominant society is actually European.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout my lifetime, there's been a constant struggle of people of African descent to assert their humanity and to be involved in the formal parts of the economy and the politics, or the political economy, if you want to put the two of them together. So if you look at the history, there were laws which prevented people of African descent from being in the House of Assembly. Stephen Dillett was, in fact, the first man to do that. The school is named after him, but he was prevented from taking his seat in the Parliament the first time he tried because mm-hmm. of the color line. So I've adopted that as part of my DNA, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and I always try to pay some obeisance to that. I think it is important still today because we're still trying to bleach our skins, still talking about who has good hair and bad hair, and you know, you got straight features or broad features, mm-hmm. those kinds of things. So there's a in the culture of the country, there's still a negative which is associated with being dark-skinned. And if we don't rectify that problem, it seems to me we have longer-term issues with the self-esteem of a nation that feels somehow that it's second class.
Hmm.
And so that's what I mean by being an Africanist.
I want to speak about your high school time there and who persons of significance who you can call. But I also would like to know about your siblings. How many siblings do you have?
There are five of us.
There's five of you? I thought it was only you and your brother. Only you and Matthew? I think you have a brother named Matthew?
Yeah, Matthew's
that's the only one I know. So yeah. I'll let you do that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I have my brother, Ian, mm-hmm. comes after me 15 months later. And then my sister, Carla, who was married to a Seymour. Then you had twins, Matthew and Marva. My mm-hmm. sister, Marva, is a dentist in New York. My brother, Matthew, is a real estate agent and salesman and broker, And that's the family and myself. I'm the oldest.
Yes.
I'm the oldest.
So you basically lead them.
I don't want to speak out of turn.
No.
But I once referred to Matthew one day. I was talking somewhere and said, "There's my baby brother." And he called me up after the show and says, "Watch that about baby now." Right? I say, "Yeah."
Okay.
So So high school. I went to St. Augustine's College, and Dawson Conliff was the headmaster at Eastern Junior.
Mm-hmm.
Where I went to primary school. And so you had people like Marietta Coakley,
mm-hmm.
who just died, Livingston Coakley's wife. She was one of my teachers there. Mrs. Watson, who was married to a man who became the treasurer. Ms. Glinton, who is still alive, who lives in Bird Ground down in Long Island. But Dawson Conliff, I went to school with Jeff Lloyd. And with Deanne Barrett, those are two names I remember. Holly Moss is another. The Fountain Brothers, Dennis Fountain. I have never had issues with school, loved school all my life. And it was actually in primary school that I think I decided to be a politician. My closest friend was a man named Austin Davis, who's now today a doctor.
It's a doctor. Gynecologist, I think.
All right.
Go ahead.
And I remember walking with him almost every morning to school and, you know, talking about various things. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, the American planes could be seen flying overhead the Bahamas. And John Kennedy was the leading political light as the President of the United States. He actually came here in 1962, stayed, I understand, for a week out at Life at Key. For an important meeting with the British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, and the Canadian Prime Minister, John Diefenbaker. And so as 9-10-year-olders, we were, you know, talking about these issues. And Jack Kennedy's most famous quote from his inaugural speech in 1960 was, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." And that stuck with many people in my generation. And on the day he was assassinated, I remember people in that generation remember where they were at the exact time they learned that he died. My neighbor, Virginia, again, she was an adult to me, but I spent all my time sitting talking with her during the days when I was off school. And she sent a message asking me to come quickly because something had happened. And I remember running through the track road in the back of my yard in Collins Avenue, where I grew up, into their yard. And we sat down in the kitchen and listened to the reports of the fact that Jack Kennedy had been shot and he had died. Really sad occasion. But I think that's where the political groundings came in. And so Dawson Conliff, as a headmaster, used to actually take me out of school, just go for a ride someplace, talk to me, and just drop me back. So one day he says to me, come go with me. So I lead the class, and he had a Chevy 2, which was a big thing in those days for me to be driving in this car with him. And we drive up to St. Augustine's College. And he says to me, these are the applications for those who are taking the exam for St. Augustine's, and you're to go inside and deliver them to the priest. And so I go to St. Mary's Hall, and I walk into the office, and there's this tall black man, phenotypically black man,
mm-hmm.
who's looking into the western window. And he turns around, and he says, you know, how can I help? And I said, well, Mr. Conliff said to bring these. And we struck up a conversation, and it turned out that his name was Bonaventure Dean.
Father Bonaventure.
That's right. And became fast friend of the world. He used to take me everywhere with him. His wife, later wife, was my English teacher in St. Augustine's. His daughter ended up working for me as the Minister of Foreign Affairs. She's now working at the British High Commission here. Very smart woman. My English teacher, of course, is still around, and so I have to be very careful how I speak.
Because I understand.
If after this program is done, I'll get a note saying, you know, your verb didn't agree with your subject and all of this, right? So I still have to be very careful about that. But so there was a kind of literal handoff from Dawson Conliffe to Bonaventure Dean. And 5 years in St. Augustine's College, Michael Barnett was my classmate, who's the president of the Court of Appeal.
Another Hannah T.C. Tynes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. His mom was related to Hannah's. And, you know, Michael wanted to be a lawyer from he was that high.
Mm-hmm.
First time I heard of Clarence Darrow and his final address to the jury, we all had to learn a speech. And Michael's speech was the address, Clarence Darrow's final address to the jury. And, of course, he's turned out to be one of the finest lawyers the country's produced. My speech was Mark Antony's address to the crowd after the murder of Julius Caesar. Mm-hmm. So you know where I was headed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it turned out. And, yeah, so I had a good time at St. Augustine's, graduated, and then went on to university in the U.S.
Yeah. So, yes, and I wanted to move there. You didn't take up law when you went to U.S.?
No. I resisted it because I actually wanted to be a writer, a journalist. But pretty soon found out that I thought that that would be the way into politics, meaning to run for office. But I pretty soon found out for some very practical reasons and also some cultural reasons that you really had to be an attorney to run for office in this country. And the practical reason is that a lawyer doesn't have to work for anybody else. Because so long as you have an employer, if you're going into frontline politics, you're pretty soon bound to run into a problem with your employer about your opinions. So you have to be in a position to be independent. I've tried to encourage all of the younger ones who want to be politicians in that direction. And it was ultimately, again, Archdeacon William Thompson, you know, I was dithering about this. In 1982, Prime Minister Pinling had said to me just before the 82 election that after the election was done, because I was running the party's newspaper, and doing most of the speech writing, public relations for the party. And the idea was for me to form my own public relations firm, something like Diversified Services was during the early Pinling era, when P. Anthony White was there, and David Probinsky, Robert Johnson, the poet. And that was the plan. But what happens is after the PLP generally wins, public relations, you know, well, we've That's in the past. You know, we've already won. What do we have to do? So now I was at sixes and sevens. The funding for the newspaper was running out. So the question was what to do next. And I went off to a resort in Jamaica called Trident Villas and spent 3 days there by myself just mulling over this question. And I ultimately decided, no, I'm not going to do law. I come back. And I'm at a party at my cousin's house, Andre Mitchell, who just passed away. And Archdeacon Thompson is there, and he sees me, and he says, what are you still doing here?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, you know, I'm working at the newspaper. He says, what? I thought you were going to study law. And I said, well, no, I decided against that. He says, look here, boy, go and study law. Go and do it. I'm telling you, go and do it. He says, first of all, you're smart. It's not going to take you that long. Just go and do it. You know, you come back. You don't have to work for anybody. People pay you money just to sign your name.
Mm-hmm.
Go do it. So,
and I know you were a media, and I know you skipped across that, but which media outlet were you working for?
Well, I started off straight out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
I was hired by a man named Bill Kalis, who ran the Bahamas Tourist News Bureau. And this was the body, which later morphed into the counselors. So Joan Knowles Albury, who owns the Counselors Limited, is the inheritor of the Bahamas Tourist News Bureau. And part of the Bahamas Tourist News Bureau's responsibility was also the Bahamas Information Services, then called the Government Information Services. I came out of high school because my cousin, Corliss Culmer, who was a Mitchell by birth, worked for Bill Kalis. And so I got this job as a messenger. And that's what I used to do, messenger and write photo captions on the side. And I would go to various golf events, you know, things in Freeport, these tourist things, and write captions and or deep captions and little stories. And that's how I got my start. So Antioch College, where I went to a university in the U.S. in Ohio, had what they call a cooperative work program. So you went to school for 3 months, and then you worked for 3 months. And so on my work time, I came back to Nassau and worked at the Tourist News Bureau. And ultimately, Cyril Stevenson joined. Cyril Stevenson was the founder of the PLP. And he was hired to head what was then Government Information Services. And I did that until 1974, when I graduated from university. And after graduating from university, the Prime Minister Pinling decided to pass an act called the Bahamas Information Services Act, which created the now Bahamas Information Services. And I hived off from the Tourist News Bureau and became part of the radio production side of the Bahamas Information Services. And I did that for 3 years. I was, the principal job then was a radio producer for the extension service of the Ministry of Agriculture. So I went around the country inspecting farms, looking at the produce exchanges around the country, and helping to assist the Department of Agriculture in spreading information about agriculture as an extension service to farmers throughout the islands. And in 1977, after the general election, the then Prime Minister Pinling said to me that the Queen was coming to visit in October of that year. And he felt that my talents would be better used at the Broadcasting Corporation preparing for the Queen's visit. And of course, television was coming to the country for the first time. So in October of 77, just before the Queen's visit, I moved to Broadcasting Corporation of the Bahamas, became the Director of Public Affairs there at the tender age of 23, I think it was.
Direct at 23?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right. And I think 70, and in 78, I became the Director of News and Public Affairs. So I was around the news operation until 1970.
And this is about the time you left and went off to college again.
Yes, I went to pursue University at Harvard to do a degree in Master's in Public Administration.
Mm-hmm.
That took a year, and came back. And when I came back, I went to the office of the Prime Minister again, because the Prime Minister had decided to try to amend the Constitution to clarify the position on citizenship. When the arrangements were settled with the British in 1972, there was a class, there were a class of people in the Bahamas called belongers.
Mm-hmm.
And these belongers had viewed the provision in the 1973 Constitution, which still exists today. They, because you didn't have citizenship before independence, this was the closest thing to citizenship. And the PLP was very exercised about this group of people, because it was said that in the interregnum, for example, I think it took about the general election in January of 1967, didn't take until I think the 9th of February to resolve itself when the cabinet was sworn in. And during the interregnum, it was said that many people were granted this status by the UBP government. Mm. Now, I haven't checked this out, but that was what was the common feeling. And so when they went to the constitutional talks in 1972, they determined that citizenship would be narrowly defined. But when you look at the way the wording of the thing, it really gives a legitimate expectation, that's what the courts later said, that these people would be granted citizenship unless you could find some reason, meaning a cause, and it really had to be something of a criminal nature, that that would prevent them from giving the citizenship. So there was a man named Darcy Ryan. I went to school with his kids.
He sued the government with citizenship.
That's right. Cecil Wallace Whitfield was the lawyer. It got all the way up to the Privy Council, and the Privy Council ruled that the government's application of the Bahamas Nationality Act with regard to that class of citizens was unconstitutional, and they struck down the provision as void. Two solutions. One is they resisted it by doing what the Privy Council said, which was to put the reasons to Darcy Ryan why they did not want to grant citizenship, and then on the basis of that, turn it down. And the second thing they determined was to amend the Constitution to make it clear that this class of citizens could not automatically become citizens of the Bahamas. So I came back in 1980, and my job in the office of Prime Minister was to manage the political campaign to support the referendum. Unfortunately, the referendum never got off the ground because it was widely unpopular amongst the elites, and not just the FNM elites, but PLP elites as well. So Michael Eldon, for example, who was the bishop, as mm-hmm. I said, gave a major address at the synod, the Anglican Synod, in that year, in which he basically said, "Don't fool with this. It's not a good idea," and the idea just died.
I want to interject here, right? Because I entered St. Augustine's circa 1988, 89, right? And I knew of a Fred Mitchell, because he came to the school and gave speeches. So every so often they have Flag Day and you happen to be invited. But the Fred Mitchell who came to that school did not belong to a political party, or had his own political party. And you're speaking of a narrative of Fred Mitchell, who is a active member of the PLP.
Yes.
So I want to know about that transition. The Fred Mitchell I knew growing up to being eventually become an independent senator. So I want to hear about that saga.
Well, I joined the Progressive Liberal Party right out of high school, out of university, 1975. A man named Brenville Hanna, another Hanna,
yes,
who lived in the Valley. He came to me and he said, "Look, you need to be chairman of the branch." Anthony Roberts was then the Minister for Agriculture and the Member of Parliament for Centerville, where I lived. So he said, "You join the branch, we'll elect you the chair." Mm-hmm. So I became the chair. My friend Kendall DeMeritt, today, was one of my supporters to become chair of the branch. And I wanted the nomination for Centerville. Perry Christie also wanted the nomination for Centerville. I, of course, was 23.
Mm-hmm.
Christie had come back, was a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
Had been appointed to the Senate by the Prime Minister. And so looking back on it, it was probably a no contest. But one of the more famous scenes I like to embarrass Hubert Ingraham with is... Ingraham was the chairman of the party,
mm-hmm.
and I was standing up at a PLP rally at the C.I. Gibson gym, and he walks up to me, and he says in my right ear, he says, Mr. Christie is a very worried man. So I said, "Worried? Worried about what?" They're law partners.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Because you have your name in the pot for the nomination." I said, "Well, why? Because I understand that he's got it in the bag, so why would he be worried about that?" He says, "Yeah, but, you should withdraw because, why don't you withdraw and let him have his 5 years, and after the 5 years, then you could have your time because he's going to get the nomination anyway." So I said, "Look, man, that means that there are only two choices. I can either get it or I can't get it. So that's a 50-50 odds, right?"
Mm-hmm.
"So why don't I just take my chances?" And he says to me, okay, but you're not going to get the nomination." Of course, it turns out I didn't. But after the next election, after the 77 election, I campaigned with, during the 77 election, I campaigned with Philip Smith in North Long Island, Rum Key, in San Salvador. Manned the polls in San Salvador, and in Long Island. I later became the National General Council member, appointed directly by Pindling in a meeting. It was the most extraordinary thing. We were all sitting around, and Bumpy Watkins, Arrington Watkins, had run for office in that year, and he said, "Look, Fred's going to be the NGC member." So that was that.
Mm-hmm.
So. fast forward to 1984 now. The 82 election was our most successful election. I had run the campaign. I was in law school. And Paul Adley was the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and he's sitting in New York at the UN. And I get a call from one of my friends in Nassau to say, oh, Loftus Roker calls me.
Another Hannah.
Yeah, another yes. Hannah. Another yeah, Loftus Roker calls me, and he says, look, there's some fast-developing events here. Midge Hannah is going to resign, and Christine Ingram, the prime minister, is going to dismiss them, and George Smith and Kendall Nottage will resign. Whoa. So this was about the report from the Commission of Inquiry. And so I didn't think that it was the right idea for Ingram or Christie to be dismissed. And so a kind of slow drift took place after 84. And Prime Minister Pinlin came to London. And for the first time, I actually didn't go to see him. Really uncomfortable time over this commission of inquiry. And because every time he came to London, you know, we were together. Mm-hmm. And he sent a message through the High Commissioner, who was then Richard Demerit. And he said, Arthur Hanna actually was sitting in the car when Richard called me on the phone. And he said, I got a message to you from Prime Minister Pinlin. He says that he's satisfied you're trying to duck him. And don't worry, he's still your friend. And anytime you need him, he'll be there to help you. And so Richard says to me, so do you have any message for me to take back? I said, no, I don't have any message. And I said to Arthur Hanna, we call him Uncle Arthur. So I said, Uncle Arthur, what'd you say? He said, well, you man. So I came back from law school, got called to the bar. And so no longer tied as I was before I left. And the question was what to do. Now, Sir Arthur Folks has told me that this is quite a cynical way to look at politics. But the fact is, if you look at how things developed, if I had not made the moves that I made post-1984, I would not be where I am today. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes an organization doesn't get to know what your worth is to them unless you step out of the box. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, well, that's what I have to do.
So you removed yourself.
Right. And set out on what I call the human rights agenda. Mm-hmm. So I did a review of the judiciary every year, which is under the fig tree. I was engaged in advocacy on migration issues, abolition of capital punishment, any range of subjects I was aware of, the LGBT issues. Mm-hmm. So from a marketing point of view, this permitted the public to actually know who I was.
You became a name brand for yourself, not for being myself. A part of the party.
Right, mm-hmm. Precisely. And I think that made it possible, therefore, in 1996, when the PLP was really down on its luck, having lost the 92 election, were looking to get back into stride, so to speak, that George Mackey came looking for me in December of 1996.
But before you move on, what's this thing about you burning the Constitution?
So there was a man named Cibola, who was a Chief Justice of the Bahamas. Okay. I disagreed with him being appointed Chief Justice. I told Ingram, who was the former Prime Minister, Mr. Ingram, who was my ally at the time, mm-hmm. that was wrong. I was campaigning for an all-Bahamian judiciary. I don't believe that judges ought to be foreign judges. Mm-hmm. No foreign judges ought to be here. Everybody ought to be Bahamian. And so in the fight over that, I made a lot of public statements about his performance, Cibola's performance, as a judge, and I thought he ought to have been dismissed and let go. So one day, mm-hmm. again, friends with all these people, Telford Georges, the late Telford Georges, was the Chief Justice of the Bahamas at the time, good friend. And he called me up and said, "Ah, Fred, I need to see you." So I said, "Okay." So I came. And he says, "Look here, you know, Cibola, Gonzalez Cibola. Oh, Joe was his first name. Joaquim Gonzalez Cibola." So he says, "You know, Joe came to see me this morning complaining about your latest statement in the newspaper and wants to make a formal complaint at the Bar Association against you for this, for these words that you spoke." He says, "I told Joe, look, you know, he's just an activist. Just leave it alone. All you're going to do is just, you know, leave it alone.
Hornet's nest."
Yes, says, "But, you know, he's insisting, so I want to tell you, I have to file a complaint with the Bar." So I said, "Well, okay, fine." So complaint was filed at the Bar, an ethical complaint against me because of these words that I spoke about him. And you know, as ever the activist, the way to dramatize that was, you know, freedom of speech being taken away. And so the Constitution means nothing if that's what you're doing. So me and my band of merry men and women gathered under the fig tree.
Yes.
My parents were there.
You brought your parents along to see this?
Yeah, my dad, the picture's there. My mother and father sitting there. And Terence Bethel, the late Terence Bethel. Mm-hmm. And we poured some fuel on it and lit it afire.
Just burn up the Constitution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Symbolic gesture.
Yeah.
So that's the story on that.
It wasn't bad. Like, how you present it is not as bad. You're an activist and you're trying to make a point.
Yeah.
A social point.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I tell the generation that, you know, civil disobedience is different from unlawful behavior. And I brought that that strength or that tradition of civil disobedience to the PLP in opposition when I was its chairman during the period 2017 to 2021. And the idea of civil disobedience, if you look at Martin Luther King or if you look at Mahatma Gandhi, is to take actions which provokes the other side to overreact.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Telford Georges was actually telling Cibola is, look, the guy has actually caught you. Because now, you know, people who weren't paying attention to him before, now that you've made an ethics complaint, this now becomes a huge thing. And, you know, I'd been used to being a public figure for a long time because, you know, as I said, television came in 1977. And so as a director of news, like the voice notes that I do today, mm-hmm. Three times a week, I used to be on television three times a week doing my opinion piece as a director of news and public affairs. So well-known figure everywhere. You know, get into, I mean, I when I was 25, I thought, gee, I'd died and gone to heaven because I was as famous as I wanted to be and, you know, walk into places, you get, you know, free this, free that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but after that event, I've never, you know, I've experienced a notoriety many times since then, but it was the height of it to me. Because once the publicity was done, the burning Constitution, all of that, I was on the front page of all
everything.
The newspapers.
Yes. You were famous.
Television.
We spoke about you often at SAC every day. Say, "What's Fred going to do it again?
Yeah.
He's under the fig tree." No, yeah. So I understand.
Yeah.
But I have 10 minutes, so I need to jump, and I got to start begging you that you come back again, so I can talk about our fig tree era. But I have to jump now. I want to speak about publics, the Ministry of Public Service, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. You seem to be gravitating towards that. I remember at one point in time, you want to rehaul the whole thing. And I want to basically ask you, why do you think that ministry is, put an S on it, is so important to what being Bahamian is all about?
Well, let's take the public service. I did as a journalist in 1980, after Michael Manley lost the election to Siaga down in Jamaica, my good friend Professor Rex Nettleford, who was later Vice Chancellor of the University of the West Indies, allowed me to meet Michael Manley, and we did an extensive interview. The one takeaway I still have from that is that part of the reason why the government of Jamaica failed under Manley was because the public administration, he said, sagged in its ability to carry out the policies of the government. And today, I keep saying to this public, to this prime minister, to the previous PLP prime minister, fix the public administration and you fix most of the problems with government.
Mm-hmm.
Because people today still are asking, why does it take so long for things to get done in government? And that's almost like a singular mission for me.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be, in one sense, a national culture of dithering. People just seem to have procrastination in their DNA, starting things late, taking too much time to execute things, not knowing what it is to report back. I was just saying to one of my constituents last evening, who was complaining to me that she had asked for a dumpster to be delivered to her place in Fox Hill. And she asked me back in March. So I'm doing some door-to-door last night, and she's castigating me because I delivered the dumpster back in March.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, it missed me. I went back, looked through the records, and it missed me, just inadvertence. And I said to her, but if I tell you that I'm going to do something and 7 days go by mm-hmm. and you don't see that done, just get back in touch with me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the public has now become so anesthetized, I use that word, to things taking so long that people are just patient to a fault.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to correct that. So that's the public service. As for foreign affairs, I said as a 10-year-old walking to school, this was a consuming interest of mine. The fascination with John Kennedy and the big conference that took place here in November of 1962. And so as a journalist, I used to do a column called The World Stage, which appeared in the PLP's newspaper every week, talking about international affairs and our role in international affairs. So when I was the opposition spokesman under Perry Christie for foreign affairs,
mm-hmm.
and so when the election took place and we won, tabs, you're it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got it, and I made it a kind of life's work. And I think it is still important. And I think people are seeing it increasingly important. We're swearing in some new ambassadors this afternoon.
You have a whole program now.
Yes.
Like a school of ambassadors and
right.
those persons. And one of these days, because I didn't bring you to speak about that, but definitely this would be a day that we need to speak on what is it that foreign affairs is trying to get at with the ambassadors, so many ambassadors and stuff like that. So I don't
Well, the footprint of the country can only be expanded by personal appearances in these places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, relationships still make a difference. And so that's what we're trying to do. These things are all budgeted. It isn't like we've gone on a frolic of mm-hmm. our own. And the idea is that even though we're a small country, you know, Pope John Paul II is a takeaway from his ministry, which is that each culture, each human being has a right to exist, an intrinsic right to exist, which has nothing to do with whether you have power or wealth or whether you're white or black or Asian. As a human being, you have a right to exist, and that extends to our culture and our nation. And I talked about the self-esteem that we have to build up in our people
yes,
to stand up for the country wherever we are. So that's the mission in foreign affairs.
Yeah, I haven't like four texts came in a row said I need to have a part two. So I'm prodding you to let you know that I plan to call you back to see we can take the interview from when you were an independent senator, right. Your activism era where you did human rights activists and speech because people want to know about that. Why were you so active in that? And which were your goals and objectives during that time? And again,
I'll leave you with this.
Go ahead.
Winston Saunders, my late friend
yes.
and former artist, told me that in the time when we were small,
mm-hmm.
that they said that you never cut a little boy's hair before he learns how to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I took a long time to talk, so as a little boy, I always had these long plaits. He said, but once they cut my hair, I've never stopped talking.
And I would like to thank you. That was Frederick Mitchell, Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Public Service. Again, this is Guardian Radio AM. My name is C.A. Nuri, and I enjoyed that conversation. I hope that you enjoy that too. I'm going to prod him and invite him back. So if you see him come back soon, that means he agreed. If it took a long time, that means I have to be working on it. But thank you very much, Minister.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much for coming on. Right, this is Guardian Radio AM, and see you again tomorrow.